If you have a Bible, jump over to Matthew chapter 6, and we've been talking about the rewards of the kingdom the last time we were talking, so we're going to keep talking about that a little bit more, the rewards that go in there. I watched a little bit of a show last night, I think it was, or maybe night before, Drugs, Inc. I don't know if y'all have ever seen that. Sometimes I'll watch it a little bit. I don't watch it too often because it's a little too real for me, and a lot of it really just kind of hurts, to be honest, just because it's kind of real. But I was watching it last night, and they had this guy in a gang, and he is talking about how he wants to, he literally said, I want to be bigger next year than this year. I want to live the dream. I want to be the man. Life is bigger and better on top. And what he's talking about is climbing that gang chain. And the funny part was that he had his face completely wrapped in a scarf and had a hat on, so you can only see his eyes barely, and you couldn't even see his mouth. And he's rolling up crack the whole time in this little, like, absolute hole-in-the-wall ghetto apartment and talking about living the dream, you know? And I sit there and I see that stuff, and my own time that I spend in the community and the gangs that I work with in the prison and in the city. And it trips me out how they will go to war and fight and shoot each other over housing projects, government housing projects, you know? I'm like, on some level, if you're going to actually risk your life and fight over something, I think I would choose better turf than that. You know what I mean? But that's the way it seems to always happen. It's like this completely delusional lifestyle. And who rules that lifestyle? Who rules that man I just described? Who rules his life? Satan, ultimately. There's an object that rules it, to tell you the truth. Money. That man's God is money. He can say it's power, but power means nothing without money in his world. So it's money. These guys I talk to in the city half the time, you talk to them for a few minutes, you'll realize that money is what decides everything. Whether it's gold chains or gold, you know, this, or a wallet full of Benjamins, they call it, you know. Whatever it is, it's money. So let's lean in this week and look at this in chapter 6. Last week, last time we were together, we talked about the rewards in heaven that relate to giving and charity and then to prayer. And now let's pick up from there. Verse 16 says, when you fast, what does that presume, by the way? That you fast. You don't have to raise your hand, but how many people do you think in this church or even in this room fast, like as a practice? Not have you ever done it before. As a practice. You know what I mean? I don't. I can straight tell you, I love to eat way too much. But it should be, he's presuming that you're doing it, just like prayer is no different than prayer. So if you're a person who actually prays, then he's presuming that you're also fasting. You're doing them both. By the way, there is no New Testament call to just stop doing it. So I don't know why we assume that's not something that matters anymore. There's never a point that it says stop doing that. Matter of fact, you may be surprised to realize you're reading the New Testament. You know what I mean? Right now. So when you fast, do not look gloomy like the hypocrites, for they disfigure their faces that their fasting may be seen by others. Truly, I say to you, they have received their reward. That's kind of the going theme here. What's the reward that they received? Everybody sees them. Verse 17. But when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, that your fasting may not be seen by others, but by your Father who is in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you. What is fasting? That's tricky, isn't it? All of a sudden, why is that so complicated? That just proves we don't do it. You know, if I said, what is prayer? Everybody got an answer like that. Huh? Stopping something. Yeah. Going without. Denying yourself. That's a good way to look at it. Telling God you're relying on Him. In fact, I would go right with that and go a step further and say telling yourself you're relying on Him. Fasting is food, sometimes food and water. We apply it to going without other luxuries, and it can. I'm not saying it's not, but in a strict biblical context, it's always food and water. And there's a reason for that. Why is it food and water? Why would true fasting be, say, food as opposed to the internet? You can't live without food. You cannot live without food. So what would be the point then of fasting food rather than, say, the internet? If you can't live without food. Forcing you to trust God, even in the impossible, is forcing. People always say Jesus fasted 40 days. How is that even possible? Moses did it too, by the way. You can go back and look in the Old Testament. Moses did it on Mount Sinai. How can he do that? That's the whole point. It is impossible in all practical purposes, but he was depending on God. He didn't need it. See, we can't accept that. That's why we don't understand fasting. Am I saying you should not eat for the next 40 days nor drink water? And that's not what I'm saying. Not what I'm saying. Between you and God, what you do. Am I also saying that giving up the internet or whatever doesn't count? No, I'm not saying that either. But what I am saying is what he's talking about with fasting, true fasting, is food and sometimes water. And it's because you are training your body that you are going to depend on God alone, even when it is seemingly impossible. Does it hurt? Uh-huh. Yeah, like physically. I've fasted a time or two in my life, shamefully. I don't do it very often at all. But even a day, and if you're not feeling real good, you know what I mean? 2 or 3 days, you're getting cranky. Like, do the people you work for a favor and eat. You know, I mean, do your family a favor and eat something. You know, I'm not trying to say that it's easy or it's so spiritual or any of that. I'm just saying that it's biblical. He's assuming that you do it. And what would you do it for? For one, to train your body to depend on Him. But what else? What are some other things that you would hope for if you were doing it? What might be a reason you decided to, I guess? Strengthen your relationship with Him. I think that's a good one. That's a big one. To seek Him, like supplication, we call it, where you're like desperately, God, please, I need an answer. And it's not like you're throwing a fit or a tantrum. Okay, well, He's going to listen to me now because I'm starving myself. It ain't like that. But it's kind of both. It's you're telling God, I mean business here. And at the same time, you're telling yourself, I can trust Him enough that even if I don't eat, He's still going to give me direction. I don't think it's as uncommon in many other places, for sure. Certainly in the Muslim world, it is a very important part of the Muslim faith. So it's about the heart, just like everything else. It's about a relationship with God. Notice he says, don't do it in public. What would be your reward in heaven if you're fasting in private? And notice it doesn't say go in a closet like it did with prayer and do it. It's not what it's saying. He's just saying don't flaunt it. That could be, that I think it'd be great, don't you think? A reward in heaven might be that he answers you. You know what I'm saying? That he gives you direction. What he's saying here is that rather than suffering and looking like you're suffering and everything else, you should serve. Listen, now an active thing here. You should serve as though you just had a great breakfast this morning and you got a closet full of food and who needs it? You know, you shouldn't be walking around like you're dragging and miserable and unhappy, and even if you are, because it's going to hurt. But you shouldn't be flaunting. You should be doing the opposite. You should be taking a positive step forward and saying, hey, man, I've got more. Because guess what? If you're not eating the food in your closet, you got food to give away, don't you? unless you can freeze it and keep it, and that's between you and yourself. But go to Isaiah 58 real quick. We'll come right back. Isaiah 58, God has a good, I don't know what you call it, thing to say, I guess, on fasting. Isaiah 58, verse, there's a pretty good bit here, but I'm just going to jump into verse 5 and just get a couple of verses. Verse 5 says, God speaking, he says, is such the fast that I choose a day for a person to humble himself? He's being sarcastic right here. He's saying, what I choose is the fast that I want, the one where a person humbles himself. Is it to bow down his head like a reed and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? What does he mean by bow down your head like a reed? You know what a reed is? Like a, you know, it grows up in the water, in the shallow water and stuff. It's got the little heavy weight on the end of it. The wind, well, what happens is the wind blows and that thing just kind of does like this. And he's saying, you're just bowing your head like this, you know, bowing your head over and over and over. And you're spreading out sackcloth and ashes under him. Basically, in a lot of ways, it's a spectacle here. You know, you're fasting, but you're making sure everybody knows that I'm putting on sackcloth out and all over the place. I'm laying down. I'm covered in ash. I'm bowing my head all the time. I'm up. I'm down. And I'm humbling myself and all these things. He says, will you call this a fast and a day that's acceptable to the Lord? Verse 6, is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of the wickedness. To undo the straps of the yoke. To let the oppressed go free. That's all doing things. That's not doing something. Now, he is talking about fasting. He's talking about not eating, but he's also talking about practically doing something while you're not eating. Verse 7, is it not to share your bread with the hungry? Why not? You're not eating it. Why? You're not eating it, share it. He said, and bring the homeless poor into your house. Oh, now you're getting personal. When you see the naked, cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. What's he getting at here? Does that sound like a miserable person? Uh-uh. That sounds like a blessed person who's got more than enough. They're giving their food away. They're welcoming people in their home. They're giving away, but they're fasting. You know what I'm saying? But those people would never know they were fasting, certainly. They look like they're as great as it could be. Times are as good as they can get. I got an overflow and an abundance. But they're actually fasting. What's the reward if you do that? Well, good old Isaiah, verse 8. Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. I'm not going to study into all that. It's just beautiful the way it's worded. But verse 9 is the money. Then shall you call, and the Lord will what? Answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. Now, does he give you what you want? Does he respond the way you want? Didn't say nothing about that. It just says, then he will answer. So the reward here is that he hears and he answers whatever the situation it is that you're fasting about. He hears, he answers. Go back to Matthew 6 and let's move on. All this is building on top of itself, so it all kind of, even though it seems disjointed, it's not. We're just picking up from last week and continuing forward. Verse 19, do not lay up for yourselves. By the way, what is do not? As a command. Make a little note, that is a command. Do not lie. Do not steal. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. It's a command. Lay up means like to keep or store or hoard or even hold. Just even to hold doesn't mean you can't have it, but it means if you're holding it at all, not clinging to it for your hold. I mean, if you're holding it, period, keeping, storing, holding for yourselves treasures on earth. Now, what's a treasure on earth? Man, there's a bunch, right? Homes, cars, jewelry. I mean, we can go straight down the list. Guitars, if you ask me, once upon a time, still have too many. Someday I'll do something with them. Irish history books now, you know. This is pretty much the theme of the prosperity gospel, the flip of this. If you're blessed, you should have treasures on earth. But this one says, lay up for yourselves no treasures on earth. None. Don't hold them. Don't touch them. Where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. You got three things there. Moth, rust, and thieves. It's pretty cool. That's the entire sinful world. Animals, the environment, and people. All of them are an enemy to what you lay up on earth. Anything you lay up on this earth is going to face one of those three. I mean, if you had a tank, okay, a tank, at some point in time, that tank is going to rust and decay and be gone. No matter how many times you try to hand it down, no matter how many generations it makes it through, sooner or later, even that metal tank is going to rust and decay and die because the environment will take it apart. Everything, period, whatsoever on this earth, our own bodies included, are subject to destruction. If it's not an animal that gets it, it's going to be somebody who steals it. And if nobody steals it and an animal don't get it, it's still going to decay, rot, or die. Whatever it is. Everything does. So he's not just being hateful by saying don't hold on to these things. He's trying to do you a favor. You can't anyway. It's foolish to do it because you can't anyway, which we all know that, but sometimes you just have to see it again. Verse 20, but lay up, what is that? Command. There's not just do not commands, there's positive commands, so he commands as well. The opposite, lay up for yourselves, which that's pretty cool. It's something from you, for you, treasures in heaven. Where none of those earthly things can take it from you. Verse 21, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Remember, he's talking to his disciples here and the crowd, but his main focus is the disciples. Is it the 12 disciples? Is it 8 disciples? Is it 100 disciples? We don't know. But it's his disciples, however many there are, and the crowd in general. So how do disciples lay up for themselves something in heaven? Something eternal. That's you or me. If you're a disciple in the room, how do you do that? What is that and how do you do it? Sharing the gospel. How does that, I agree, how does that lay up treasure for you in heaven?
Well, I think, you know, when people come to know the Lord.
Sure. When people come to know the Lord, those people are part of your family now. And those people will be eternally there. Sure. Sure. Well, you're working for that same goal and there's treasure in that. That's right. And you may never know how many people are going to be in heaven as a result of anything that you may or may not have done. But be careful that you don't, you know, there's that song where everybody lines up to thank you for all that you did while you were here on earth. And that just ain't true. Toss that aside. I'm not hating the song, but nobody's going to thank you in heaven. You're going to be in the same line thanking the same person. Okay. And that's one person and that's Jesus. That's it. Nobody else is thanking you. Because were it not for him, you would have no reason to be there either. All right. So, but that being said, yes, that's a big one. That's a huge reward. That people, brothers and sisters, will be there. That's a treasure that you can find in heaven that you do here on earth, that you can lay it up there for you. It's for you. You know, that's a good thing. For me to be able to have family, I mean, I assume most, if not all of you in this room are believers in Christ. If you are, that means, hey, we're just practicing right now. We got this forever. That's a reward for me. That's cool. That's awesome. I love that. That's a good thing. What else? What else could be a reward in heaven? Serving God, period. I think him say, y'all have heard me say this a bunch, but him saying, well done, you did good. You did good. That's a reward. But it's not just going to happen. I mean, it's a reward. It comes because you did do good. How about knowing his word? I got a little secret for you. I don't believe, and those of you who've been here with me for a long time know, we did a study of Revelation. I'm an Old Testament junkie. I don't know everything the Bible has to say, so I have holes. But that being said, I am pretty well certain that you're not just going to have all knowledge when you get to heaven. Because there's still only one person that has all knowledge, and it won't be you. Even the angels at present don't have all knowledge. Do you realize that? It tells you, even the good angels are amazed. The Bible tells you this, at what God is doing through the church. If they're amazed, that means that there's things they clearly don't know or didn't see coming. Satan certainly is in the same category. So those are angels. All right. Don't expect that you're going to have all knowledge of all things. That would be a pretty boring heaven for me, if you want to be honest. You're designed to learn, to grow. You're going to have a new body that's able to do that all for the glory of God without sin. That's what the new body is going to do. It's not going to be full of all knowledge and no need to learn, grow, or do anything. It means that your body is going to be free of sin, death, and decay and able to do all things for the glory of God, whatever you learn or do, which is awesome. That's another reward. So, hey, spend some time in his word. His word's going to be around, just letting you know. You know, once you die and go to heaven, it's not like, thank goodness I don't have to study the Old Testament anymore. His word is eternal. It's his word. It says it's eternal. It will be around. So, I'll give you a cool proverb. You don't have to turn to it. Just write it down. Proverbs 13:8 is pretty funny. It says, the ransom of a man's life is his wealth, but a poor man hears no threat. Let me read it again. The ransom of a man's life is his wealth, but a poor man hears no threat. What's he saying? You got nothing to lose? You ain't got nothing. Nobody trying to rob you? You could count that one as a blessing. You know, nobody's trying to rob you. That's a good truth. But again, here, the issue is the heart. He says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So, the trick here is, I always read this wrong in my younger years, that you need to change your heart and your treasure will follow. But that will never happen. That's not what he's saying here either. He's saying, change where you put your treasure and your heart will follow. But don't try to change your heart. Change where you put your treasure. And if where you put your treasure is in heaven, guess what that does about what you treasure? Changes that too. All of a sudden, now the things that you might have treasured, you don't really treasure no more because your treasure is in heaven. And in heaven, that won't go. So if it won't go, then it starts to change where your heart goes. And suddenly your heart is for people. And suddenly when you see somebody hungry, it's not such a big deal to give them something. Suddenly when you see somebody that has no clothes, it's not such a big deal for you to give them your clothes. Because suddenly people become what you treasure. And not stuff. And I'm not saying this as somebody who's doing it right. I'm saying this as somebody who's reading it right. Maybe I'll be doing it right one day. But heaven becomes your reward because you stored your treasure there. Let's go on. Verse 22. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? Now, this is pretty confusing, and it seems randomly stuck in here. But it's not. It's there for a purpose. In fact, it's couched right in this talk about money or treasure. The key is in verse 23 when he says, the light in you. We get confused because we think of an eye. And you think, well, the eye is the light of the body. But then he's talking about your body will be full of light or full of darkness, and so we want to think, well, it's about what you look at or whatnot, but that's not what he's talking about. That's not even the context of what he's talking about. He's talking about a spiritual eye. Like, you might hear the third eye, or that's not what he's saying, but I'm saying that idea, the inner eye is what he's talking about. And your spiritual eye, your inner eye, what guides you from the inside, that is the lamp The lamp provides light. Light provides a path for you to go down. If that inner eye, if that light in you, if that guide in you is actually darkness, he's saying, how great is that darkness? That's the blind leading the blind. That's how he would put it at some point. The context here is money. One commentary puts it this way. Jesus plays on a familiar Jewish expression. Jewish people sometimes spoke of a good eye, which means a healthy or sincere eye, as being generous, and an evil or unhealthy eye as a stingy one. So what they would do is, I can't see your inner eye. I can't see that in you. But if you are a stingy person, if you hold on to everything, we would call it a Christmas time. We'd call it a Grinch or something, you know, or what's his name? Scrooge. Yeah, that kind of thing. That inner eye that holds on to something, you automatically know what kind of person that is. You might say, well, there's some good deep down in there, but that's beside the point. You know what kind of person that is. Because if in Scrooge, in the end of the story, his inner eye has changed. Because now he's given like crazy. You know what I mean? And you can see something has changed in him. And the darkness now is a light. It's just a euphemism. It's like we say his feet never touch the ground. What does that mean? Are we talking about his literal feet? No. Or what if we say he has lead feet? That's the opposite, but it's not, still not talking about feet, really, are we? All right, same idea. Another commentary says the Pharisees had a problem because their spiritual eyes were diseased. With their eyes, they were coveting money and wealth. Thus, they were in spiritual darkness. They were slaves to the master of greed, and their desire for money was so great that they were failing in their service to their true master, who is God. Look at verse 24. Goes right into that. No one can serve two masters. This is so heavy. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. No neutrality. No neutrality. You cannot serve God and money. The word money there is a Greek word that's literally related to wealth or possessions. It's not strictly cash money here, but most likely money is the predominant translation. But it can include all those things. So we always quote this. You've probably heard it before. You cannot serve God and money. But there was more to that. He gave you options. You'll either love one and hate the other, or despise one and be devoted to the other. No neutrality, like at all. It's not just talking about sin either. It's talking about money, possessions of the context. So how can you serve money or possessions or wealth? Devoted, see, he says that. You'll serve two masters. If that's a master, how do you serve that? It controls you. Yeah, it starts as your main focus, and then it begins to control you. If you're serving it, see what I'm saying? It's more than just you want it. You're serving it. That guy in the illustration I was talking about before, he's clearly serving money. I mean, he's risking his whole entire future, life, everything to get it. Not just from being shot, but let alone the police and whatnot. You begin to serve it. You don't have to be a crackhead to be in that case either. Plenty of financial people. Plenty of business people. Plenty of restaurant people. It doesn't matter who it is. If you're climbing the chain and your focus is on serving money to the point that other things begin to slip away or aside, you're now serving it. But he didn't just say money or your family. Money or this. He says money or what? Me. Yeah, God says money or me. One of the two. It's money or it's me. What does he mean that you will hate one and love the other? In this case, let's say that you're on the money side. Let's say you're a Christian and you realize that you are serving money. God says, well, you'll hate me. Like, well, I don't hate God. He says you will.
One's about building your own kingdom and one's building about God's kingdom.
Sure.
He asks you for what you have. I mean, and you don't want to give it up. It's probably going to make you pretty bitter.
Yeah, at him. I think that's exactly right. Yeah. If he asks you to give something up and you don't want to do it, or you find some way around it by saying, well, that's not really what he wants, then, yeah, you're going to become bitter at him, because why is he asking me to give that up? You know what I mean? Or why, or the vice versa. Why won't he give me that? Why did he give it to them and he won't give it to me? How come God gave it to this person and I don't have it? How come they get their bills paid as a Christian and I'm struggling? How come he lives in this house and he lives in this house? You know what I mean? It's not just about jealousy and covetousness. I'm just saying that it's the idea that God, you get bitter at God, you get mad at God, you begin to despise God. Despise a heavy word, but it's really the truth. If you start ignoring him, you're despising him. That's really the truth. If you're ignoring anybody, you despise them, you know, because it just means you don't need them. It's not a problem. You don't really need them. And you start proving yourself to be really devoted to the other things. Because if you're really devoted to God, then you wouldn't be having a problem. And the opposite is true. The more you begin to devote yourself to God, the more you won't really care about those things. And in this case, if you're devoting yourself to him, you ought to be despising money. Now, it doesn't mean you can't have any, or you shouldn't have any, or you should stay broke. It doesn't mean that. It just means it should appear as though you hate it. I'll give you a great example of that you're all familiar with. You don't have to turn to it. You can just note it. In Luke 14, Jesus says this. Great crowds accompanied him in verse 25. And he turned and he said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Is Jesus telling you you should hate mom and dad? I mean, that's what he wrote. Obviously not. That'd be breaking a commandment. Honor your father and mother. He's not telling you literally to hate them in the sense, I hope you die. But he says, your mom, your dad, your wife, two will become one flesh. Why is he? What's he saying here? By the way, your own life is in that list as well. What's he saying here? Yeah, Christ has to be your number one. Listen. To the point that, to the world, it might look like you hate your own family. I've said this before. You guys have heard me talk about it, but Molly and I have been, so many of you have, but Molly and I have been in parts of the world where it's illegal to be a Christian. So illegal that it is prosecutable by death. And we met, as I've told you before, a man in a country in West Africa not too long ago that gave his life to the Lord after 9 years of seeking him. And for him to do that puts not only his life in danger, but his family's life in danger. He could get his dad fired. Not joking. He could have his brothers and sisters arrested if they don't deal with him. You must hate your family, son. You must hate your family. How could you put your family in that position? Now, he loves his family, but he hates his own life in comparison to Christ. Yes, he would hate his own family in comparison to Christ. And he's displaying that because he's been put in a position where I can't serve two masters. That's what he's saying here when he says you'll love the one and hate the other. He's saying if you love Christ, you're going to hate money. Not I hate it, but people are going to look around at you and say, why are you living like this? Get a raise, dude. You know, why don't you do better for yourself? Provide for your family a little bit better. You don't have to live like this. Why are you selling everything and taking your family to that place? Your kind of wisdom you got, you ought to be making bank by now. You can give it to the church, you know. Funny how different ways we can twist all of that, you know. But that's what he's saying, okay? Let's go on. Well, before we do, let's sum up how far we've come, okay? So far, and we'll finish up here pretty quick, he's gone over a few different things, and let's make those things real practical before we move this last piece in. He talked about giving already in this chapter, not just in the church, but also to the needy. So you need action statement, give. to the church, but also to the needy. Pray corporately, privately, both. Quoted prayers and personal prayers, both. Fast, which I would argue is don't eat for the sake of training your body to be dependent on God. Training yourself that you can be dependent upon God. And then devote yourselves to love and serve God only, even forsaking earthly treasures. And listen, here's the key to all of those. Giving, fasting, praying, devoting yourself to God. All four of those things are to be done how? In secret. Why? So we don't get the glory. Only He gets the glory, period, if you are never seen. If you're never seen, only He will get the glory. And that is the hardest part of it. I promise you it is. Because pride in every one of us, as a child of Adam and Eve, pride in every one of us wants us to get some little piece of it. At least a pat on the back, please. At least a thank you. Please, something. But that's not where it comes from. For us, we have treasure, yes, but ours is in heaven. And listen, things that are treasure are only those things eternal. That's the easiest way. What's treasure in heaven? Easy. It's eternal. Whatever is eternal is treasure. That's it. Everything else, the moths will get it, the thieves will get it, or the rust will get it. Everything else. The only thing that you can define as treasure is something eternal. So, God, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, God, He is eternal. He's treasure. Isn't that enough if we just stop right there? But God, He is treasure. His Word, Bible says it's going to be there forever. It is eternal. His Word endures what? Forever. It's eternal. That's something that's awesome. We can treasure that. That's why people live and die for this right here. That's why people are dying today to get this into countries where people can't, don't have it, because it's eternal. It's worth dying over. Fruits of the Spirit. Those are eternal. Love, peace, patience, kindness. Y'all know them. Those things. Grow those things, because those things will be around forever. Those things are eternal. Souls. Souls are eternal. Both directions. So it's important to invest in those. Mankind, however you want to look at it. And God's creation is eternal. Some people would argue that, but I won't. I believe, without a doubt, the Bible's fairly clear that God created things good, and He's in the process of restoration. And does that mean invest in this world? Yes. I'm not going to give a green speech or any of that stuff. I went everywhere yesterday trying to find gas that didn't have ethanol in it, okay? So I'm not going down for my lawnmower. I'm not going down all of that. I'm just saying that I believe that this world is something He eternally values and will restore. It's got to have a lot of work. It's got a lot of problems. That's our fault, not His. But He's going to fix that, I believe. And I believe the Bible teaches that. These things are your reward, not a golden palace. I remember growing up in the Southern Baptist church when I was younger, before I went crazy for a while, and always hearing about these mansions in heaven and everybody's mansion that's going to be in heaven and all this stuff. That's not, mansions are not eternal. That's not the case, okay? So Jesus puts an exclamation point on all this with this last bit. Let's get it in real quick. It'll only take a second. He says, verse 25, therefore, having said all of that, let me sum it up with this. Therefore, I tell you, don't be anxious about your life. Anxious is like worried or excited or nervous or whatever. Why attach worry right after saying what He just said? Praying, fasting, worshiping money. Why is He saying now don't worry?
Because you just said a bunch of things I'm probably
going to do. Yeah, I know. Yeah. If I'm giving up, if I'm praying and I'm fasting, that sounds like I'm worrying about something already. And most of us only pray and fast if we're worried about something. I'm guilty of that one. So that already sounds like a problem. And then if you're telling me I don't need money, I mean, you know, yeah, what do I do? It sounds like worry right off. But what He's saying is, if you feel like you have money, you have no worries. If I have money, I have no worries. Then what does that make money? God. your master. As long as I got money, I got no worries. Don't need God. As long as I got money, I got no worries. You know, do you need money to eat? See, this will twist your thinking, don't it? Not if you collect seed and grow your own garden. I know it. You do. I'm not saying don't work. The Bible says if you don't work, you shouldn't eat. Okay? It's there. Okay? I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, don't think that if I don't have money, I don't eat. That's not true. I see plenty of people getting provided for that don't know how they're going to eat, but they find it. God provides it somehow, some way. That's his whole argument here. I'm not saying be lazy. I'm not saying that. Should work. Should provide for your family. It's biblical. I'm talking about a heart issue, remember? This whole entire discussion has been a heart issue. Look at verse 25. Therefore, I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, care, concern, worry. What you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you'll put on, is not life more than food and the body more than clothing. You know, an easy way, by the way, to keep this in context is remember that you're already dead. If you're in Christ Jesus, you died 2,000 years ago on a cross. So you don't really have to worry about these things in a lot of ways if you're already dead. But in the context here, he's being very literal and he summarizes life in two ways. Life is what you eat and what you drink. Okay? And he summarizes your body in one way, a covering, or what covers it, your clothes. Look at verse 26. Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? Awesome little statement there, by the way, that tells you that you are more valuable than an animal. You're not just another animal on this planet. You have more value than the animals. I'm an animal lover. A couple of German shepherds, as you know, I love animals to death. I'm not talking about hate animals. I'm just saying, you're not just an animal any more than I am. We are of more value to God than animals. Why are you of more value? What makes you different from the animals? If you have a soul, huh? Yeah, we're a picture of God. We were created in his image. Genesis chapter 1 tells you, some argue that's where we have a soul comes from. We're created in his image. Whichever way you look at it, without going into a deep study of that right now, the fact is God created you and me in his image for his glory. That sets you apart from everything else on this planet. And then he even says he put everything on this planet in subjection to us. So you're not equal. I don't care what science tells you. That's not the case. You have more value. Verse 27. And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? Circle that, type it out, and put it on your refrigerator. You know what I'm saying? I wish I could actually get my heart to accept what those words say. You cannot extend your life a millisecond by worrying about it. You might shorten it. I know, that's a good point. You cannot extend your life a millisecond by worrying about it. You can't do it. And then he says, and why are you anxious about clothing? So he talked about your life, what you're going to eat or drink. Now food or clothing for your body. Consider the lilies of the field. They grow. They neither toil nor spin. They don't work for it. Talking about the beauty of the flowers. They don't work to get more beautiful. They just grow. And beauty adorns them. And he's saying, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. I love that. One minute he talked about how the animals are. We are much more value as mankind than the animals. But now he's saying this man king was not as beautiful as a little plant that don't even live for a few minutes. God equals it out, you know. And he says, if God so clothes, colors, decorates the grass of the field today, which is alive and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you little faith? Man, that is so condemning in light of all of this. You little faith. You of little faith. Therefore, do not be anxious, saying, what are we going to eat? What are we going to drink? What are we going to wear? For the Gentiles seek after all those things. I'm a Gentile. What he's getting at here is those who don't have God. You as Jews, you have access to God. You have his word. You're Jewish people. You know who he is. Whether you believe in him or not, that's not what he's saying. He's saying you have access to God. He is your heavenly Father in that sense. Even those who don't know God, he's saying, even those who don't have access to them, they seek all these things. They're looking for clothes. They're looking for all that. And your Father, what does he say? Knows what? That you need them all. So he's not saying you don't need them. You don't have to have them. He's saying he knows you need them. He knows you need them. And you do need them. He says that. He knows you need them. So he sums it up like this. A simple little how-to. So what do we do? Jesus, verse 33. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. By the way, you have none. That's what he's been arguing through all of chapter 5. You have no righteousness of your own. None. You're sinful like I'm sinful. He has righteousness. And he says, seek that first, and then all these things will be added to you. So don't seek the things of this world at all. Seek two things. What two things? His kingdom and his righteousness. That's it. And if you seek those two, the others get added as well. How much food? How much clothes? How much? We don't know. What you need. Now, what you need doesn't necessarily mean the minimum to survive. What you need means what you need to accomplish his kingdom's work. So if you're a super giver, he may flood you with resources. If you're a person who struggles with money and whatnot in terms of hoarding and holding and whatever, don't be surprised if he's trying to strip you of them because you don't need them. So one of the two. But the focus here is you focus on these things. They come with the kingdom. Don't look at them specifically. You access the kingdom through his righteousness. Real quick, too, there's a picture of Christ in all this. It's awesome. Don't worry about your life. Die to yourself. Okay, just note this. Don't worry about your life. Die to yourself. Seek his righteousness. The Bible tells us we put on Christ. We put on his righteousness. Christ described himself as the bread of life. Food. Christ described himself as living water. There's your drink. And he is our covering. What were the very first clothes? Animal skins. Why were they clothed with animal skins? As a sacrifice to do what? What was it covering? Their sin. The shame of their sin. It was cut. Very first clothes were not to decorate their bodies. They were to clothe and cover their shame and their sin. And Christ is the same thing. He is a covering. I'll give you a couple of verses real fast. Just note them. Psalm 37:4. Awesome verse. Memorize this one. Delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. That's awesome. Delight yourself in the Lord. He will give you the desires of your heart. You want your heart's desire? Desire what God likes and he'll give it to you. That's pretty good. Another one, Psalm 107:9. For he satisfies the longing of the soul, and the hungry soul he fills with good things. They come from him. Verse 34, last verse of Matthew 6. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. That's good to know. Proverbs 27:1 says, do not boast about for tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring. What's going to happen with you tomorrow? Who knows? You got something on your calendar. But unfortunately, Lord willing. Isn't that what we always say? If the Lord, one of the pastors here always said, if the Lord tarries, you know, same idea. You don't know if you're going to make it till tomorrow. I don't have time to go into it, but read 1 Timothy 6 sometime. Paul talks in great detail about money and about the role of money and how that money desire can destroy you as a believer. As a believer. He says godliness with great contentment. Or godliness with contentment is great gain. What does that mean? I'm good. I'm good. And you're living a godly life and being good. Not living a miserable life wishing God would do better by you. You know what I mean? Yeah, I think, too, the thing to remember about this is so hard is, I just read it. It all sounds good, but it's hard, isn't it? It's hard not to worry. But he said, don't, which means you have a choice. You can choose not to, but that's hard. Here's the way that you learn to not worry. Pray. Give. and fast. Exactly the things he started out with. Train yourself you don't need food by fasting. Give your money away. And pray. Focus on him and his kingdom. Thy will be done by what? Kingdom. You know what I'm saying? All right, let's pray now and go.